the midweek drive, zooming into the future and energized by the now.
Well, in the first part of the program, we found that Anna's favourite Christmas present of all time was the duckling she received. Doesn't quite know what happened to the duckling, but we presume it became a beautiful swan, which is fairly important. Graham Harper now joins us now, our BAFTA award-winning director. How are you, Graham?
I'm really well, thank you very much. Hope you all are.
Excellent. Well, I mean, I figured that it was only right that we actually put on a slide from It's a Wonderful Life in the background for the benefit of the listener who appreciates that the theatre of the mind is so important. And Jimmy Stewart, of course, very much at the heart of this Frank Capra classic. We've also got Hermione Araclete back with us. Hermione in Southend. Graham, have you ever done anything in Southend? Or is that too leading a question?
No, I've been there. I know it very well. Well, quite well.
I've been there as well. I was there when BBC Essex was there, when one of the chaps who actually introduced me to radio was head of news there. That was many years ago there. I think it was actually the last century. So, Hermione, why is Southend a cool place to go to this Christmas?
Well, I mean, we have the longest pleasure pier in the world, and we're now a city, so you can't get much better than that.
the city of Southend and the longest pleasure pier in the world, and yet Anna is in Coventry. Can you believe it? I don't know. It's just one of those strange things. Graham, we've been talking about kind of people's thoughts for 2024 as we head into this new year, etc. Anything you'd like to share with us from your own eminent position?
Well, it's not that eminent. I just wish we'd have some peace in the world. I think it's awful at the moment. Everywhere seems to be in trouble.
Yeah,
apart from obviously
Middlesbrough and Acton and various other sort of bits and pieces, they seem to be fairly free. And as far as I can gather, Washington DC isn't too bad. Although I know that Phil Learness is secretly working deeply to ensure that many states will follow Colorado and actually forbid Donald Trump from actually standing. But that's a whole new world, isn't it, Phil Learness?
I am not addressing that one way or another. I mean, you are digging a hole for me, and yes, happy holidays back at you.
Exactly. And we're hopefully going to be joined in a few moments by the wonderful Sarah Huntley, who, again, has been busy doing all sorts of things over the festive season. What are your hopes for 2024, Phil Learness?
For me personally or for the world writ large?
We can take both if you wish.
Is there a difference? I have some really fun creative ideas that I've been putting together that I'm ready to launch. Maybe a new radio show nationally here, and that would have a live component of a live stage show that I would do every so often. So we're gonna put together some proof of concept pieces, a full live show and an episode of the radio show, and we'll see how it goes. And then I have a couple of documentary series I'm really excited about launching. So,
oh, what about?
So there was a documentary back in the late 1980s here in America that was for public broadcasting, called Things That Aren't Here Anymore. And it was made and hosted by a rather legendary newscaster named Ralph Story. Was there ever a better name for a newscaster than Ralph Story? He sadly is one of those things that's not here anymore. But it was successful enough that there was a sequel to it a few years later, More Things That Aren't Here Anymore. And I've always been intrigued both as a storyteller, but also as a traveler, of going and learning about places and people and things that may not be apparently visible anymore, that hidden history beneath the seeming surface of things. But I also don't like to deal strictly in the sad, because I do believe that this could be the good old days that someday we will talk about. And so I have this concept of a travel show called Things That Aren't Here Anymore and Some Things That Are. And so I will go places to tell the story through hosts of these places that are lost to the annals of history, but things nearby that very well could become lost to the annals of history if we don't pay attention to them and we don't treasure them.
Oh, that Sarah sounds Huntley, really interesting.
Are you worried about things that might be lost to the annals of history, or is it a case of, no, I'm going to be brave and battle through for the next few years at least?
Oh, I think Phil's absolutely right. I think now I'm the age I am, one of the lessons I keep trying to tell myself is what I think is awful and difficult, people who are 30 don't think so. And so therefore, some of how you're perceiving things possibly is your age. Some of it is you've got, I agree with Phil, there's good places and bad places to go back to. And what we don't realise is life's good, really, because amazing things are happening all the time now as well. And I suppose I really think that's a fascinating idea, Phil. I think it will be brilliant because I think it will appeal to every age group. But then there are sort of gems of things I go, oh, about, and only people like Graham and Alex would go, oh, with me about, because they kind of they'll probably have to connect on the same level. But I think that's I think it's very 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 good idea. I think it will be very interesting. So I hope
I
that goes.
also I also am motivated, and I alluded to the radio show that I plan on launching and this live show. And one of the things that I want more and more all my expression to involve is hopefully being a voice in the wild, saying we're always hearing about how divided the world and the nation is, how polarized everything is. But truthfully, I have traveled all over America, which is, for my money, still one of the top 20, 30 countries in the world. And I have never seen any such thing as what people refer to as red states and blue states. This is such a common expression here. There's red states and blue states, meaning liberal versus conservative. And or now, never mind liberal and conservative, people say leftist or MAGA. And so we hear about how polarized everything is, but the truth is, I have crisscrossed this country. I've gone to every state. I always drive on two-lane back roads. I eschew the freeways altogether. And I have never been in a blue state. I have never been in a red state. I have only encountered people who, for the very most part, are really kind and generous. And I'm really drawn to stories that remind how, no matter what those things are that are separate us, there genuinely are more things that bind us together. And hopefully I can find these stories that do just that.
Allowing for the fact that I'm currently actually in the frozen north of England, kept warm only by the kindness of a furry hot water bottle, then what else can I actually say in terms of a variety of other key things? I thought that would excite you, Sarah, but anyway, it is a very, very generous furry hot water bottle, and one that I shall forever treasure it, as I alluded to in the first part of the program. Jessica Burtis, any thoughts for yourself? I mean, do you view North Carolina as being out of the norm, or is that a case of, Phil, you've clearly never been here or tried our boiled peanuts or sweet tea?
No, I mean, I think what he's saying is completely true. People will surprise you no matter where you go, and I think it's very hard to very strictly define people. I feel like we try to. I feel like increasingly I see people, especially defined by polarized terms, and I think that we end up forgetting the person in it and how complex people are, no matter where we are. I like to think New York or North Carolina is a pretty cool state, though. I don't know. I think we're pretty fun. But yeah, I think, and I mean, I do think it's interesting too with, as with anywhere, borders are often so, arbitrarily made, and oftentimes things are very regional. They cross over borders, and you have similarities that overlap borders that have been made politically. So I think that's always interesting when, most countries are broken down into smaller categories of states or counties, provinces, but oftentimes people have so many similarities all throughout them.
The views.
I am. Oh, sorry. I had kind of a Christmassy theme that I wanted to introduce here, based on what Jessica just said. I've been writing a book for many months now, and one of the chapters involves angels. And I don't know if I believe in angels, even though a movie about angels is what inspired me to become a filmmaker. But I
The
do
Avengers,
believe.
Wings of Desire.
I do believe you are correct. What does he win? Nothing, sadly. But I do believe in travel guardian angels. I have just experienced it too many times, where when I have been at my most vulnerable, traveling possibly without having planned very well, it is always a stranger that shows up and not only makes sure that no ill comes to me, but provides me with memories that are frequently transcendent. And I do think that there is something in us. One of the best things about us is that when we are at our most vulnerable and when we are traveling, let's not kid ourselves. No matter how much planning is involved, we are vulnerable. And that t vulnerability actually does tend to bring out the very good in people quite often. And so, again, inspiring people to travel to places that maybe they've been told are not for them because, oh, they're on the other side, they're on the other team.
Like Middlesbrough, for instance, Phil.
Well, that's the obvious exception. That would be the obvious exception. Don't go to Middlesbrough. By the way, is it true that if that furry water bottle, if we could equip it with an AI voice, we would never hear from you again?
I couldn't possibly comment, but it's truly wondrous.
We
So,
are all sorry.
have you been guided on your guardian by your guardian angel on your journeys from Wimbledon to Foy and back?
I have, because I ended up driving practically in the middle of the night. I'm so sorry I didn't make the show because of traffic jams and things. I think keep calm. It's not raining. I know these country lanes. I know here know how to get here. But I think Phil's right because a couple of weekends ago I went to Vienna. And I was at the tube station going to Heathrow, and there was this American chap who suddenly got off the tube with me and my husband at Earl's Court and went, "Oh, it is," and I felt my heart went for him because we were all thinking, "Crikey, there's not one showing for Heathrow. This isn't actually looking very good. This is actually a plane missing situation." And he had something like 3/4 of an hour to get there to check in, and I didn't know him, and I just carried, you know me, I talk for England, but I kept talking to him. And when he got off the tube, he said, "Thank you so much. Even if I've missed my plane, you've kept me calm," because I was going, "No, it's going to be all right. It's going to be good." But one of the things I think, I was a bit down the other day, and I think this time of year brings up all the people that you're really missing that have gone up to into the stars, and then you get nostalgic for other times, and then you think, come on, smell the roses on the way and everything. And one of the things that really brought a smile to my head was, I suppose, whatever stage we're all at, if you could add this into your program, Phil, you don't realize how brilliant it is at the time. So all the wonderful times I've had with Alex and Graham, I've taken a little bit for granted. This has been brilliant doing Casualty. This has been brilliant doing Bad Penny. But you know, when you look back, I think that was really rather brilliant. Not that I'm really rather brilliant, but it was a really
Yes, you were.
rather brilliant time. And so I was feeling a bit, and I thought, right, I must get out of this, Huntley. So I went for a swim. Pardon me. And where my gym is in Wimbledon, it's next to the Odeon Cinema, and there was this quite young chap at the top at sort of 10:30 on a Saturday morning. I mean, mid-30s with a group of like six girls of about six all around him, super excited because obviously it was somebody's birthday. And I thought back to when it was my daughter's birthdays and you're doing these parties, and this chap looked completely out of control because obviously his wife had gone to get something and left him with the party. And this little girl was coming up on the escalator, and her mother was waving to say, "Yeah, that's the birthday party." And they were all very excited. I couldn't work out what film they were going to see, but something at 10:30 on a Saturday morning. And as this little, quite plump little thing got off at the top of the escalator, they'd all got their party dresses on at 10:30 at Wimbledon Odeon. And she went, "Mother Goose, do we all look good?" Just sort of thought, "Oh my God, I really made me laugh. Mother Goose, do we all look good?" And in her little world, this was the pinnacle of not just the weekend, the week. And they'd all got, you know, and this poor chap, thinking back, was like, "Oh, what do I do if one of them says I want to go to the loo? Or what do I do? What do I do?" And they were so excited. And I think younger people show you that they're not getting put down about, oh, let's not get the politics, the wards, the things, the true emotions coming through, or the excitement of being with your best mates, going to see a film that you've been looking forward to all week, and that you were probably eating chocolate at 10:30 in the morning. I mean, I just thought, how brilliant, really. And I suppose that's where it's so important to keep your lives intermingling. And generally, I believe, like Phil, I genuinely believe people are good. It's only a few people that aren't.
Is like Anna's experience with the duckling, which you received. How old when you what was it when your uncle gave you a duckling for Christmas?
Was for Easter, and I was five.
Five
Oh,
5-year-old.
You know, I have an experience that I would really love to hear Graham's take on, because you've heard me say before how much, when I am able to come back to your shores, I would love to get to sit on in the studio and watch Graham work. But when I was a very young director starting out, of course, most of the people I would work with would be older than me, and I credit that for something that is in my makeup now, as I am well into, let's say, the middle years, which is in work all those decades ago, but in life now, I want those souls around me who are older than me to enjoy themselves. And I want those souls who are younger than me to feel good about themselves. And what I want from the souls that I would consider, let's call them my peers, is I want intimacy. I want them to know that I will listen to them and that they will listen to me. And it occurs to me that that's the kind of director that Graham is from the stories that I've heard.
Oh, Graham, very, very, very much so. He's so understated.
He's
He's
in the
so
room, Sarah.
funny. I'm
He's
here.
yeah.
He
He's
is.
not dead. He can speak for
Yeah.
still.
Papa is.
Graham, your thoughts on Phil's little comments there, and would you allow him to watch you play?
The answer is you'd be really welcome. I would dread what you would say afterwards, though, because I may shatter this illusion. I went to see a fantastic, well, I think it was fantastic. The reason why I'm saying I think it was fantastic, there was one particular actor I couldn't understand a word he was saying, and unfortunately, he was one of the principals. He was the conflict. And he was rather wonderful, I think, but I can't guarantee it. And there's a reason for me saying talking about this. So the play was what was the play? The Motive and the Cue. Now this is a play that's been written about the conflict between Richard Burton and Sir John Gielgud. I think he was a Sir John by then, but he may not have been knighted in 1964. I think it was 64. And they were about to play, they were going to rehearsal for Hamlet, Burton playing Hamlet. And he'd made Cleopatra, etc., and had kind of become a massive film star. And now he was returning to the theatre. And I have to tell you, when I was 13, I went to see him in Julius Caesar at the Old Vic. He was absolutely brilliant as this young, exciting Kenneth Branagh type of. He was a wonderful actor. He is a wonderful actor, was a wonderful actor. Anyway, these two people did not get on. It was the old fashioned, losing his favor, Sir John Gielgud, who was the old guard, as it were, and Richard Burton, who was considered the young guard coming in to play Hamlet. The difficulty between the two of them was that. Sir John, I hope you don't mind me waffling on about this, but it's important because of what Phil's just said. Sir John Gielgud was excited because his star was waning, and he was asked if he would do a very modern version of Hamlet, a really pulled back, lacking props, whatever, a really pulled back version of Hamlet. Richard Burton, unbeknown to Sir John, wanted to become the great modern classical actor like him, but in a modern technique. So the two clashed because one was trying to get a very modern version and at the same time giving line readings, and the other, Burton, was wanting to show his great master of the old classical style of playing Hamlet. At least that's what I got from the play. So they clash. And they clash very bitterly and badly, and they don't listen to each other. They do listen, but they get on the wrong end of the stick of each other. And so there's massive violent, not violent physically, but violent verbally conflict between the two of them in front of the cast of 12 people who all had to witness the horror. The reason I'm saying that is they didn't listen to each other properly, and they could have helped each other. And in the end, without spoiling anything for you, any of you, if you want to see this play, they finally get there. It's extraordinary the acts they go through. You have to listen to each other and you have to understand each other's points of view. And somewhere there's a gem, there's a little nugget of something brilliant that makes you suddenly find exactly what you need for that particular scene. But you can only get there if you really listen to each other rather than be dictatorial to each other.
Graham Harper's words of advice there for Benjamin Netanyahu and Hamas, which is very important.
Oh, my God.
You are determined to just kill off the holiday spirit.
We love that play. Don't you think, to me, what became apparent, which I thought was so moving, was at the end of the day, the play has to go on. And however much actors disagree, don't like playing with one another, opposite one another, we've all had that when you've had a leading man that you don't speak to off stage. But the thing that I found quite moving was when they do go and that music starts and, Hamlet starts, they have to find a way of working together for the sake of the production going on. That's what I took from it.
But there is a magical moment in it throughout this horror. This horrible situation goes on for 19 days, I think, maybe a little more. And at the end, having bared their chests to each other and really flummoxed each other, they suddenly, Sir John finds, by sort of by accident, and also by Burton's wife, Elizabeth Taylor, they have a conversation together, and she gives him a clue to the complexity of this man, of his where he comes from, and what's happened to him as a young boy, etc. And that's the point. Gielgud listens to her, and he, by chance, by luck, he picks up on one moment, and he uses that bit of information in a private conversation the two of them have, and it suddenly they just Burton discovers, having a big discussion with him about this horrible situation that happened when he was a young guy or a period. He suddenly, Gielgud says, "Play that, make that your Hamlet. That's the way to play it. Use that." And he then plays this actor, Johnny Flynn plays Richard Burton. He suddenly, this bloke playing Burton is Burton. You think you're watching Richard Burton. By the time you get three quarters of the way through the play, that's Richard Burton you're watching. He suddenly plays a famous soliloquy from Hamlet in such a fantastic, oh, it really, really gets you. And you suddenly, before your very eyes in the theatre, realise what a brilliant actor Johnny Flynn is, and what a brilliant actor Burton was once the nugget had been found. Ah, oh, it was stunning.
Well, talking about finding nuggets, let's go to our winner for the second year running of the Arthur Weingarten Midweek Drive Contributor of the Year Award, Jessica Burtis. You threw into the chat in betwixt times, "A British lady saved me on a train once. We need to know the story, please."
It's a very long story. It's an
It's
action
all right.
story.
Hermione doesn't really want to do anything other than sort of listen to the whole thing in the first place. So carry on, carry on.
I had been visiting Ireland. Actually, it was during the February break when I was at Lincoln, and I flew back and I was attempting to save some money, which was a poor choice on my part because I ended up having to take two buses and two trains in England at night, and I ended up getting at some point took a very bumpy bus to a bus station in Sheffield at night. And what I didn't know, because I'd only ever been to the train station, was that the bus station and the train station were across the street from each other. I had no idea. So I was in the bus station waiting for a while because I had a ticket and it said that I had to go from Sheffield to Lincoln at a certain time. And my ticket didn't say if it was a bus or a train. And I tried to ask the desk attendant in the Sheffield bus station, and he did not know anything. He was too busy talking on the phone with a woman named Stella to know what I was saying. He didn't know what was going on. I
Customer
didn't know.
care in Britain, it's second to none.
I didn't know what was going on. He didn't know what was going on. It was nighttime. It was freezing. There was no heating. So I was in like five jackets. There was nobody else there except there's this one-footed pigeon actually at the train station in Sheffield that I've mentioned. And he was like my buddy. I would see him every time. But yeah, short story, to make the long story short, eventually I realized that I had to get to the train station and my train was leaving in 2 minutes. And if I didn't get there, I would have to spend all night in this bus station until I was able to go to Lincoln the next morning. But I went to the train station and it didn't say my platform on the ticket, and I couldn't find any sign saying that was working where my platform was. And I remember I ran down some like a flight of steps, and nobody was there except for this British lady and I guess her son. And they didn't know me. I know them, but I looked at them. I must have had just the absolute most panic in my eyes because I said, "Where is platform? Blah, blah, blah." And she stood up and pointed and was like, "It's that way. Go up the stairs that way." And she saved my life. She was like my British fairy godmother. And I feel like we bonded more in that moment than most people ever will in their life. I'm very grateful to her. I didn't have time to stop and ask her name. So I flew up the stairs and then I went down more stairs and I ran onto the train and 10 seconds later it left. So I made it to Lincoln. I walked shamefully back to my flat and I probably went to Alex's class the next day. there was a lot more to it, but that's the Cliff's Notes version. But it was the most stressful night of my life and I don't want to repeat it.
It reminds me of The Dresser, the film of The Dresser, and the actor manager with an entourage of 20 actors or whatever it was, traveling from one place to another on a station, and they've arrived late and the train is just about to go out, and someone says to him, "The train's about to go," and he says, "Stop!" And they did.
It's like that the British lady, she could have stopped that train if she'd wanted to. I know she had the power to. She saved
and she probably did.
You know, the reason to me that these stories like really resonate and matter is because, like I said, we're so vulnerable when we're travelers. And I think we lose sight of the fact that we're always travelers. I mean, that's all we are. We're just hurtling through space on this tiny little rock, and we're traveling somewhere, and we all like to think we have laid out where that journey of our life is going to go. But for the most part, we really spend a lot of time not knowing where we are, why we're there, or where we're going. So we are a vulnerable traveler all the time. And if we're capable of caring for each other, of realizing that moment that of for whom the bell tolls, that we recognize in a total stranger that if I don't help them, some part of me is at risk. And if we're capable of doing it, then we're capable of doing it all the time.
Alex Hoskinel, any thoughts from yourself from Romania, or indeed Coventry, your current base?
I was just thinking of one time last year. I flew for the first time last year here to the UK, to Coventry, obviously. It's my eighth time here. Anyway, and I was living back home and I am doing long distance with my boyfriend, and I was living for the first time and I was so distraught. I cannot put into words how upset I was. It was my second time in an airport. I was alone here. I was waiting for the plane to Romania. I was in Birmingham and I did not know what to do, how to figure things out. I had no connection on my phone because I had my Romanian number. I couldn't talk. I was a mess. And I was there sitting on a chair and literally crying, crying, crying. I was keeping my head down and I was crying to my phone. And I know a lady came and I knew her from the plane when I came. And she knew I was going to my boyfriend because we sat next to each other and talked for a bit. And she gave me candy and she hugged me. And she said she's not on the same plane to Romania. She's going to Italy. But she's so happy that she saw me and she took my head in her hands and she looked at me and she said, "You have the most beautiful eyes to be having tears coming out of them." And I cannot tell you the way I started crying again. I don't know. I have met the most amazing people while coming from the airport or by dropping him off. Those were the
and
most heartbreaking
moments. Did she have
moments.
A pet pigeon by any chance, Anna? And did she say she was also off to Sheffield?
No, but she was such an amazing woman.
Well, it may be the secret superhero heroine who actually is out there with her pet pigeon, effectively rescuing travellers. It could be a whole new world, a whole new series, perhaps. Hermione in Southend, has such manifesting magic ever happened for yourself on the journey up to Lincoln and back?
I feel like I'm going to just kill the mood. No. Every time I travel from Southend, it's just like everyone keeps to themselves. No one talks to each other.
Very British. So there we are. Jessica, the moral of the story is, for
Well,
God's sake, don't go to Southend.
Hermione, it's not bad that you don't have that story. It means that nothing has gone wrong. The point of a travel guardian angel is they show up to save things right before it gets really, really bad. Yeah. So
this is very fair.
Yeah, it means that unlike the rest of us, you, because of being a good person, are living a blessed life. The rest of us, yeah, we're meant to struggle.
I'd love to tell you, following on something Phil said before about traveling all over the place, and he takes the back roads. When I was the first assistant director of the BBC, part of my job was location managing. They didn't have location managers. And one day it was pouring, sorry, it was absolutely pouring with rain. I'd gone down a country lane looking for a water mill for Mill on the Floss was the production I was working on. And I couldn't find this blooming water mill that was on an ordnance survey map. I got lost. And I went down this track, came to a dead end with two cottages at the end of it. And it was pouring with rain. I was looking at my map and a bloke came out with an umbrella, young guy, and he tapped on the window. He said, "You lost?" And I said, "I am." And he said, "Do you want a cup of tea?" And I said, "Oh, that would be lovely." So I went in and had a cup of tea with this young guy in his house. And he said, what are you doing? And I told him what I was doing. I was looking for this water mill. He said, "Oh, I know exactly how that is." And he took me to it. So that was that. So a month and a half later, we're now filming in a woods near this water mill for another sequence to do connected with the water mill. And it was the first day, and the principal actress in the story, the principal matron of the story was late, 20 minutes, 8:30. We still hadn't turned over. She hadn't arrived. She turns up, and I'm really cross as the first assistant. And I say in front of everybody, stupidly, "This is not good enough. If we go on like this, we will never get this started, never mind finished, blah, blah, blah." And she said, "You can't talk to me like that. I am a principal actor." And I said, "Well, I've just talked to you like that. Don't let it happen again." At the same time, someone came up to me and said, "Graham, we've got a big problem. We can't get the generator in because some fool's brought an E-type Jaguar down into the woods, got stuck in the mud. What do we do?" I said, "Well, we'll all have to go out and sort it." So we all went up and got this car out of the way. And guess what? It was driven by the young guy who said, "Do you want a cup of tea?" And he just decided he'd like to come and see us filming. At the same time, I was really fed up, but I had to be very kind to him. And at the same time, his eyes met the costume designer's eyes, and they fell deeply in love with each other on that day. And a year later, they got married. Isn't that extraordinary?
And those are just some of the narrative tales that Phil Lynas will be using in his next series of Tales of the Unexpected, courtesy of Phil Lynas.
Oh, my goodness. I have a great story, really brief. A buddy of mine from Wales made a movie there called The Englishman Who Went Up a Hill But Came Down a Mountain. And he was out. He wrote and directed it, and he was with his producer, and they were in a car, middle of the night, coming from a location. You know, and they made it in a small town. So out in the countryside, middle of the night, they come to the one stoplight. And it's red when they get there. There's no other cars around. But he's used to driving in America and there being cops hiding everywhere. So he stops. And they get into an argument over something that had happened that day on the shoot, the producer and he. And they're arguing at this light, stopped there for a long time. And at some point, apparently, another car had come up behind them. And so after about a 10-minute argument, there's suddenly, in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the night, a rap on the window. And it's this little old lady. And they suddenly realize, and she just very politely says, "Are you waiting for a particular shade of green then?" I don't know what accent I was doing. My apologies to all of you, but hopefully it at least portrayed some of the charm of this woman.
I sensed it was Irish, which is always good. So it's positive from that side of things there. To Sarah Huntley. Sarah, have you had an interesting Zoomer, and have you enjoyed the Zoomer with us today?
Oh, I have. I feel terribly Christmassy. I feel it's beginning to feel a bit like Christmas. And all those stories, Phil, I think you should really do this series because it just exudes warmth.
It captures the whole thing. Very in mind.
That have happened to them.
Sarah, I appreciate you for reminding reminding us that as joyous as this time of year is for a lot of people, it's a time of loneliness and sorrow and of remembering that which is lost in those who are not here. And I hope we always keep those people in our hearts at this time of year. And that when we remember that when we are one of those people, when we feel alone, there's always the opportunity to connect with somebody else.
And you have to then go, I'm sorry, I've got to say it. Every time a bell rings, an angel gets its wings. That, to me, is what life's about.
Which, of course, is one way of wrapping up, but we'll be finishing off with God Bless Us Everyone, as I promised in the first hour of the programme.
Oh.
Graham, have you enjoyed the Zoomer?
Really, really smashing. Thank you very much.
Good. Back with us again in the near future?
As soon as you want, yeah.
Excellent. Phil Leirdas, has it been good for you?
I mean, aside from the fact that you still haven't let me say what I'm doing for the holidays, but every week he asks everybody else, what are their plans? And then when it comes around to me, he interrupts. So, but I understand. It's the furry water bottle speaking.
It's
I
true. Absolutely. Very
it's
true.
Been lovely. It's been lovely.
To Phil Leirdas, to Graham Harper, to Anna Coscanell, Hermione Aracleti, and Jessica Burtis and Sarah Huntley, huge thanks. We'll be back again in a whole variety of other bits and pieces as well. But can we all finish with those immortal words? God bless us, everyone. After three. One, two, three.
God bless us. Oh, sorry.
God. God. Whoa, God bless us, everyone.
Everyone.
No, in answer to your question, no, we cannot. Alex, no, we cannot.
Mean it.
Will it really be the same? Will it really be the same?